Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and we're recording this at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 5th of February. Our main stories: as the number of deaths approaches 500, China's president calls for tougher action to control the coronavirus outbreak. Meanwhile, scientists are about to announce a new name for the illness. And more than 30 people have died in two avalanches in Turkey. Also on the podcast:
3 years ago, we launched the Great American Comeback. Jobs are booming, incomes are soaring, poverty is plummeting.
President Trump makes a pitch for re-election as his impeachment trial nears its end. And later...
It's great to have that dynamic where I could be both sort of characters. I could be Captain Verdi and in my spare time be a Bhangra artist.
We meet the Bhangra artists who fight for Queen and country. China's president says he is confident of winning the war against the coronavirus, but efforts to control it are at a crucial stage and tougher enforcement is needed. Millions of people have been ordered to stay in their homes in China, with one designated person allowed out every few days to buy food for the household. In Hong Kong, the territory's leader Carrie Lam announced 2 weeks' quarantine for anyone coming from mainland China.
We will invoke the powers to enact substitute legislation for people coming from the mainland, including Hong Kong residents, mainland residents and other visitors. They have to go into compulsory quarantine for 14 days.
We'll hear more about restrictions in Hong Kong, but what is day-to-day life like in China at the moment? A question for our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton.
In parts of China, it's pretty grim. The number of people who appear to be living under these really strict quarantine procedures, these are people who, primarily in the provinces of Hubei and in Zhejiang on China's coast, are living under, as you described, people that are being told to stay at home. They're given tickets, and they can only leave once every 2 days, one person from the household. If they're caught outside not holding their proper ticket to show that they're allowed to be out, they will be fined. Just today, the Chinese president Xi Jinping, just in the past hour really, has threatened more legal proceedings against those who don't follow quarantine measures. So really, we're starting to see the government really kind of trying to show the positive news on the one hand. Today they said, you know, we're doing a better job now of testing. We're able to diagnose this much faster. We're able to rule out suspected cases who don't have the virus much faster, send them back home. But on the other hand, we're hearing the finger wagging from the government saying to the people and to officials, look, you need to follow the orders. You need to follow these quarantine measures that we have in place.
Yeah, in Hong Kong, we heard them tightening the border yesterday. It's partially closed, not sealed, as some medical staff there want. But now another tightening. Is this the result of that death in Hong Kong?
I think it's the result, really, of just public pressure and anxiety in Hong Kong. Every time we talk about Hong Kong, we have to go back to the SARS crisis in 2003. Hong Kong suffered 40% of the victims, the deaths from that. There's a real anxiety. There's a real push this time to not repeat that. And so there's a lot of pressure on the Hong Kong authorities to completely close the border. They're not going to do that, primarily for, I think, political reasons. The chief executive, Carrie Lam, is under pressure from Beijing to really stay united with the rest of China. But yes, she's announced new restrictions today. Anyone who had traveled to Hong Kong from mainland China will be placed under compulsory quarantine. I don't know how far that will go, though, to really relieving that ongoing anxiety in Hong Kong that the virus really could break out seriously there.
She's also announced the closure of two cruise terminals. There is a ship currently docked in Hong Kong where passengers are being checked. There's also a cruise ship in Japan. I mean, I guess those are very dangerous places for the spread of these kind of viruses.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, they're little floating islands, aren't they? So yes, Japan seems to be quite a serious case. This is a cruise ship, the Diamond Princess, 3,700 people on board. 10 have been diagnosed with the virus. We had been receiving information yesterday that they were just going to test everybody and let them off the ship. Obviously, plans have changed. That ship is now floating off the coast of Japan, and it looks like they're going to be there for about 2 weeks, it seems. The entire ship will be put under quarantine. In Hong Kong, yes, another cruise ship docked 3 people have been diagnosed with the virus so far. This is a tricky one for the authorities. Health officials in China said just today, look, we're really learning more about the virus day by day. We're realizing that people can have the virus for around a week, very mild symptoms that don't really show that they're very sick at all. And then on day 9 or so, that's when they start really showing quite serious symptoms. So day by day, they're learning about the virus, but that doesn't really help those people floating on those cruise ships.
Celia Hatton. Well, the virus, which emerged at the end of 2019 in the city of Wuhan, is currently known as 2019 nCoV, short for new or novel coronavirus. But in comparison to terms like bird flu, swine fever, or even the Black Death, it's not that easy to use and hasn't really stuck. So a special committee is coming up with a new name, as I heard from the BBC's Jasmine Taylor-Coleman.
Well, viruses do often take a while to get a name, and that's because it's really important to get it right. But in this case, it's a massive outbreak. A lot of people are worried about it, so they've been under a lot of pressure. There's a group of scientists working at the International Committee of Taxonomy in Viruses. There's 11 of them there, and they've been debating this for about 2 weeks, trying to find the right name that they can then put forward to the scientific community and for the wider public. It's difficult and it takes a long time because there are certain cautionary tales and rules that they have to follow. The rules are set by the World Health Organization. They're more a set of guidelines. They include things like the name shouldn't be named after a geographical location. So they use MERS, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, as an example of what they don't want to see. They're worried about stigmatizing certain areas of the world, in that case, the Middle East. They also don't want the name to reference any animal. So they look at swine flu, for instance, which was actually the H1N1 virus, became known as swine flu, even though it wasn't passed by pigs. But in Egypt, they slaughtered all of their pigs as a response to this. So there's a real danger that fear-mongering leads to big decisions like that. Other rules include don't reference a particular culture or a particular industry even. So some people have been calling this the Wuhan seafood market pneumonia. There's a danger that that could have negative consequences for anybody working in the seafood industry or anybody working in markets. So there's some really strict rules that the World Health Organization wants people to follow.
OK, so those are the rules of what they can't say. How can they decide what they should call it?
The World Health Organization wants the name to be short. It's often acronyms, I think, are quite useful. Also, it's important that the name is catchy, it has a hook, people actually use it, because obviously there are lots of names out there already. It needs to be easy and quick for people to use. So we'll see what comes up, but I think they'll have something that is an actual word that people can pronounce properly. You have to be able to pronounce it ideally in more than one language. So it should be something short, pithy and catchy.
And when might we get it?
Well, the name is being submitted to a scientific journal.
So they already know what it is?
So the board has decided on a name. The 11 people have come to a decision that they've got a name and they've submitted that to a scientific journal. Once that's then been published, so that they know that the scientific community accept the scientific grounding for that name, they're then going to announce it. And that should be in the next few days, perhaps the end of this week.
Jasmine Taylor-Coleman. In his third State of the Union address, President Donald Trump says he's presided over a great American comeback. But as he made his pitch for re-election ahead of November's presidential poll, divisions with the Democrats were clear. Aline McBull reports from Capitol Hill in Washington.
You could hear those chants of 4 more years even here where I am, outside the House chamber, as Donald Trump stood inside addressing the nation. It was a taste of the rapturous reception he'd get from Republicans all night in a bombastic State of the Union speech.
3 years ago, we launched the Great American Comeback. Tonight, I stand before you to share the incredible results. Jobs are booming. Incomes are soaring. Poverty is plummeting, crime is falling, confidence is surging, and our country is thriving and highly respected again.
And so it went, with Republicans cheering him to the rafters and Democrats sitting sullen in what felt like a campaign rally right here in the Capitol building.
Under my administration, 7 million Americans have come off food stamps and 10 million people have been lifted off of welfare.
It was too much for one Democratic congressman, Jerry Connolly, who I caught leaving early.
He demonized immigrants again. He, of course, lied about statistics again. He took credit for all kinds of things that he had nothing to do with. It was shameful.
And my fellow Americans, the best is yet to come. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless America. Thank you very much.
And as soon as it ended, the most senior House Democrat rushed out of the chamber. Speaker Pelosi, your reaction to that speech?
I tore it up.
And she did, quite literally, tear up her copy of the speech transcript. Given impeachment proceedings are still going on, Democrats, like Rashida Tlaib, might have hoped the president wouldn't be so upbeat. Why were so many of your colleagues so angry?
The fact that he's bragging about taking people off of food assistance, the fact that he's saying, look at what I've done, but in the long run, no, you haven't.
That didn't sound like a president ground down by the impeachment process or embarrassed by it.
No, that's what you saw there is reality TV. This is not reality TV. This is real life. We're tired of it. And you know what? No matter what, he will be always the forever impeached president.
Impeached, but the Senate won't remove him when it votes later today. Like almost everything he does, this speech divided a nation. But it's no wonder the president appeared in such good spirits. With the chaotic first showing in Iowa for Democratic presidential candidates too, this week is looking like a very good one for Donald Trump.
Aleem McBool in Washington. So a shambolic start to the Democratic Party's presidential campaign, with full results still not in from the Iowa caucuses as we record this podcast. And later on Wednesday, as we've been hearing, the Senate expected to clear the president in his impeachment trial. So a good couple of days for Donald Trump, as I heard from our correspondent Jane O'Brien inside the US Congress building.
A very good couple of days for Donald Trump, and as we had just heard from Aleem, effectively using the State of the Union address to launch his re-election bid, and coming on the eve of the vote in the Senate in just a few hours' time, where he is expected to be acquitted. We do know that the Republicans have the numbers to do that. Any waverers among them have now declared that they will acquit him. And I think the big story that we're watching for is whether or not any moderate Democrats will defect from their party, cross the aisle, and also vote to acquit Donald Trump. Now, if that happens, the Republicans can claim that they have a bipartisan acquittal. This isn't just the Republicans saying, no, we're standing by our man. This will be Congress actually looking at the evidence and deciding that any wrongdoing he may be guilty of did not rise to the level of impeachment.
And that would reinforce a very bad few days for the Democrats. Which Democratic senators should we look out for?
Well, you've got two moderates in particular, Joe Manchin in West Virginia, Doug Jones in Alabama. Both of them are in tight re-election battles themselves, particularly Doug Jones. It's possible that they might cross the aisle because I think at this point the Democratic Party may say, well, we know it's a lost cause, that we failed to impeach him. We might as well try and salvage what we can. And if you need to vote to acquit him, then in order to save your own seat, your own campaign, then you might as well go ahead and do that. That's very possible. But of course, there is also the history book that everybody's playing to, and it's also possible that these senators who are playing things very, very close to their chests may decide that they want to register their vote for the history books and not just as part of their own re-election campaign.
Meanwhile, many of us outside America are hearing a new Democratic name, at least emerging towards being a front runner. Mayor Pete, tell us about him.
This is a real rise from rags to riches. He has been the underdog in this campaign ever since he declared he was running. In his words, he went from adorable to plausible, and now he's trying to prove to Americans that he is, in fact, electable. And in spite of the chaos from Iowa, the results so far, just under three-quarters of results have been returned, show that he is in the lead, which is quite extraordinary. He's also polling very well in New Hampshire. He's openly gay. He's actually married to his partner. If he wins the nomination, goes on to win the presidency, we could see the first married gay couple in the White House, which would be an extraordinary move in this country, which is still very conservative at its heart. But he does have a long way to go. Of course, this is only the first contest. We haven't got the full results. There are 9 months to go before the election itself. There's a lot to play for, but certainly a very, very good start for Pete Buttigieg.
Jane O'Brien in Washington. Nearly 40 people, including rescue workers, have died after two avalanches slammed into a mountain road in eastern Turkey. Officials said an emergency team sent to Van province on Tuesday after the first avalanche struck were caught in a second one. Hugh Morgan reports.
The first deadly avalanche happened late on Tuesday, trapping a minibus as well as construction equipment. One construction worker was able to escape and raise the alarm. About 300 rescue workers were at the site on Wednesday searching for survivors when the second avalanche happened. Police officers, security guards, one firefighter and a number of civilians are thought to be among the dead. Search and rescue efforts are continuing. Video footage shows rescue workers using shovels and sticks to try to find survivors. Specially trained dogs have also been sent to assist.
Hugh Morgan. And still to come on the podcast. Why the language of penguins follows the same rules as human speech. A government offensive in the last rebel enclave in Syria has caused one of the biggest waves of refugees since the civil war there began in 2011. Many of those fleeing are women and children. Idlib has seen some of the most intensive bombing of the conflict, with Russian air power supporting Syrian forces. Our World Affairs correspondent Paul Adams has this report.
This war has displaced millions, and after 9 long years, it's still happening. Idlib, the last rebel stronghold, a mass of desperate convoys. As President Assad's forces close in, whole communities are on the move. Many, like the Moglaj family, packing their belongings in the town of Binish, fled here from other besieged towns and provinces. They're being uprooted again. It's a grim, familiar routine.
I lived in Kfar Aouid. We were safe and happy. Then the bombing and war took place, and we were displaced for the first time, then a second and a third time.
The government's offensive on Idlib is remorseless. Towns pulverised by shelling and airstrikes, inhabitants forced to flee north and west. Some places, like Ma'ash Shurin, now ghost towns. The UN says that almost 600,000 people have been forced to move in the last 2 months, and the process is picking up speed. They're slowly converging on the Turkish border. Turkey is building up its military presence in the region. The latest fighting has seen deadly clashes between Turkish and Syrian government forces. A deal reached 2 years ago between Turkey and President Assad's Russian backers, now hanging by a thread.
Paul Adams. Investigators say the alleged scam involved a fake Jean-Yves Le Drian, now the French foreign minister, who was apparently requesting funds by phone and Skype for a secret mission. Carney Sharp spoke to our correspondent in Paris, Hugh Schofield.
It is the most extraordinary story and a tale of the most extraordinary chutzpah, if you like. The allegations surround a campaign that was led between 2015 and 17 by a group of men to hoodwink very senior and wealthy people from around the world into believing they were being contacted by the French Defence Minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, now the Foreign Minister, of course. And they did this by, first of all, phone conversations, and then later by actual video conversations with these people in which they wore a mask, a kind of rubberized mask that, to make them look, or the, one of them, to look like Jean-Yves Le Drian. There's a photograph of this mask circulating, and it doesn't look particularly professional, but they managed to convince a number of their victims that it was Jean-Yves Le Drian and conned them out of an awful lot of money.
Honestly, I mean, as you said, they called tick, they sent emails tick, but they used Skype. How do they create a fake foreign minister? It sounds a bit like Mission Impossible, although this time it wasn't.
Well, I mean, the allegations is that they're led by a man who is already a convicted fraudster, who's a great con man, basically. And what they did was ring up these people who are all international figures, like the president of Gabon, the Archbishop of Paris, the head of big companies around the world, and they would say to them, look, this is France calling, in effect, we need your help. We're in a spot. You know that we have, France has got some people who've been kidnapped in the Middle East. We can't do this publicly because publicly we don't pay ransoms, but we've always paid ransoms. So we need a secret channel of money to go to the foreign ministry to pay this ransom. And even though they targeted 150 people, most saw the scam or at least didn't get involved. But three people, right, including the Aga Khan and including a very wealthy Turkish businessman called Inan Kiraç, that paid up more than 50 million euros for this scam, believing that they were helping France and they would get something back later on.
That's
so
extraordinary.
It worked.
Extraordinary.
They made this massive amount of money.
Absolutely extraordinary, because this is identity theft. I mean, it is the world's fastest growing crime, but this was just on another level. They also planned to impersonate other people, didn't they?
Well, that's the allegation. They were arrested, at least the two ringleaders, alleged ringleaders, were arrested in Ukraine 3 years ago now, and it's alleged that they'd gone there to get a new mask made up, and then that would have been of Prince Albert of Monaco. That is not a feature in the charges in the court, but that's been reported widely in the press here, that they felt they'd done enough with Jean-Yves Le Drian and were moving on to other, you know, impersonating other figures.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. Thousands of Sikhs once served in the ranks of the British Armed Forces. Today, the number has dwindled to a mere 170. But in a move to recognise their distinct Punjabi culture, two Sikh soldiers are being encouraged to share their love of Bhangra music, as the BBC's Poonam Taneja reports.
Traditionally, this kind of music is heard in the northern villages of the Indian subcontinent during the harvest. Now, thousands of miles away in London, musicians Diljinder Singh Verdi and Chamandeep Singh Sandhu rehearse.
Chama, are you singing or dancing or what?
Yeah. Or shall I do the same one, two more one?
But there's a twist. Both men are dressed in army fatigues inside a gym at a military base. Captain Verdi, as he's known to his colleagues, has served as an officer in the British Army for 6 years. But his love for Punjabi folk music goes back to his childhood.
So I was born here in the UK and quite visibly a Sikh. Wear a turban very proudly, and you know, that's my ancestry, that's my heritage. And for me, the Punjabi culture is a way to connect to that, and it's a way for me to understand where I come from.
He plays traditional Indian instruments, while his fellow soldier and musical partner, Lance Corporal Sandhu, provides the vocals.
I was born in Punjab, and from the beginning I was passionate about singing and Bhangra, and I never learned singing or dancing. I was just listening folk music, and I was passionate.
Chaman Sandhu, it is Modda Jorke, shoulder to shoulder on the BBC Asian Network.
For the past 8 years, they've released a number of Bhangra tracks under the name Jinder Music and performed across the world. But the pair have led double lives, keeping their music and military careers strictly separate. Until now.
So it's great to have that dynamic where I could be both sort of characters. I could be Captain Verdi and in my spare time be a Bhangra artist.
And what do your colleagues think?
Recently, I have performed Bhangra in my Bhangra outfit on our cultural day in my regiment, and everyone loved that.
Given the only Bollywood film that I know, it's Kuch Kuch Hota Hai.
Their cultural traditions are supported by senior army colleagues like Lieutenant Colonel Tim Transky, who promotes diversity in the forces.
It demonstrates the fact that you can embrace your culture within the culture of the army, that the two are not mutually exclusive, and indeed that they're mutually reinforcing.
Olé!
Sikhs have played an important role in the British Army for over 150 years. About 250,000 Sikhs are thought to have fought for Britain in both world wars. More than 80,000 were killed. It's a historical link that's recognised by Lieutenant Colonel Wendy Fawkes. Her job is to highlight arts in the army.
To have Captain Verdi and Lance Corporal Singh
to showcase what they can do and what is out there, then we can get other people to step forward as well. And why not have a Bhangra dancing troupe within the military that we can then take to communities to show that they can practice their own cultures as well as experience the military?
There are only about 170 Sikhs currently serving in the British Armed Forces. Military chiefs hope that by supporting Punjabi culture, more may be encouraged to join. Meanwhile, Captain Verdi and Lance Corporal Sandhu will continue with their musical careers while serving Queen and country.
Poonam Taneja with that report. Does retail therapy, the act of shopping to improve the mood, have a bigger effect when buying a luxury item like a handbag or watch? According to research from Boston College and Harvard Business School, for the majority of people, the answer is no. It can actually make you feel worse. Lawrence Pollard spoke to Dr. Nalia Ordabayeva, Professor of Marketing at Boston College.
We were going into the research trying to test whether or not the feelings of higher power, confidence boost that consumers would typically expect from buying luxury products would actually translate to higher confidence and power feelings when they actually consume these products. And to our surprise, we found that that confidence boost might not actually materialize, and that a lot of consumers actually question whether or not they're being true to themselves when they wear and consume these luxury products. So the main finding of this research was quite surprising to us. And what was even more surprising was to find that many consumers across different sections, socioeconomic sections, demographic sections, actually feel this way.
And where do they come from? Because you'd have thought if you wear or use something in your daily life which makes you, or you see it every day and it's a constant reminder of your success and your status and your expenditure, that that would work. So why is there this shortfall in what we expect luxury to give us?
What we find explains these feelings is this typical association, deeply ingrained association that consumers have with what luxury represents. So we're used to seeing luxury products on high-class individuals. It's associated with royalty, with upper class, with the privilege and wealth in society. And so we tend to automatically think and imagine this wealth and privilege when we are faced with luxury products. And so when we're consuming and wearing these luxury products, we question whether or not this imagery of wealth and privilege that luxury represents actually corresponds with our true selves. And this questioning of whether or not we deserve this privilege and high class and wealth that luxury represents, that this questioning of the self leads us to feel inauthentic and like a fraud.
Is there any particular, either a socioeconomic group or a geographical group or a kind of luxury where this is a bit different? Are there people for whom it does work?
That's a great question, because we were thinking that there must be something about your wealth level and whether or not you can afford luxury that must predict or reduce these feelings of inauthenticity. But what we found was that these feelings of imposterism actually cut across the board, cut across socioeconomic classes, and we actually have plenty of evidence. And we found that consumers across the board actually report feeling inauthentic. But the one factor that we find can reduce inauthenticity feelings is this inherent sense of entitlement that some consumers just inherently have. And so it's kind of an interesting factor. It's an interesting characteristic. So we were able to measure it by applying this well-established scale that includes items like, if I were on the Titanic, I deserve to be on the very first lifeboat. And some people, rich or poor, actually feel that way.
Dr. Nalia Ordabayeva talking to Lawrence Pollard. Now, you might not associate penguins with deep and meaningful conversations, but French and Italian scientists have found that their vocal patterns follow the same general laws as humans. The newsroom's Richard Hamilton reports.
The scientists from the universities of Lyon and Turin studied nearly 600 sounds from 28 adult African penguins in Italian zoos, recording and analysing what are called ecstatic display songs, like this. (Laughs) They found that penguins use what's known as information compression, a way of making communication efficient. It's the first time this behaviour has been observed in animals other than primates.
These calls are used in territorial displays, so these penguins are very defensive of their territory. They're also used to attract a mate, so the song can help to advertise how big you are, how fit you are.
Stuart Semple is Professor of Evolutionary Anthropology at the University of Roehampton in London.
These songs follow what are known as linguistic laws. These are the common statistical patterns of language. A very simple one is Zipf's law of brevity, which says that more frequently used words tend to be shorter. And then longer words in language tend to be made up of shorter syllables. So the larger the whole, the smaller the parts. And these are fundamental laws across many, many different human languages. They're the mathematical underpinnings of our communication system. And while these penguin songs clearly aren't language, they nevertheless follow these linguistic laws, showing that these songs are perhaps a little bit more similar to language than we originally thought.
In his original research, Professor Semple found these linguistic laws applied to monkeys and chimps, but he thinks these fundamental principles are used throughout the animal kingdom.
Richard Hamilton. And that is all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on the podcast or anything in it, send an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.